Hello and welcome to the Technically Legal Podcast. This is podcast 115 for Friday, February 3rd, 2012. I'm David O'Brien.
I'm Dominic Rabier.
And I'm Andy Sellers.
And before we get into any of the stories tonight, I'd like to introduce a new guest host on our show, Andy Sellers. Welcome, Andy. Andy is a colleague of mine and a fellow and also an attorney at the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard. And we're hoping Andy will join us for the coming weeks. So this week, we'll be talking about a couple of stories. First, we'll give you our take on SOPA and some other legislative developments. And second, we're going to talk about the mega upload mega story. Andy, why don't you kick it right off?
Sure, I'd be happy to, David. There has been so much discussion over the past few weeks about the Stop Online Piracy Act, or SOPA, and its counterpart in the Senate. It's hard to know where to begin exactly. But I figured we'd start off by talking a little bit about what the law is and what the law does. If you break down the law, there's sort of two major parts to it and then some other complementary parts. The complementary parts, probably not worth going into any great detail. They largely concern certain ratchets of enforcement. One interesting thing that might be worth talking about would be the inclusion of public performance as a criminal Copyright Act, whereas it's normally confined to civil. As well as increased damages when you do things such as sell counterfeit goods to the military. But the focus of all of the analysis and discussion has largely been on the two major sections of the bill. The first, which is Section 102 of SOPA, concerns an ability of the Attorney General to target certain specific websites and get court orders enjoining them from committing piracy or copyright infringement. And then being able to take the court orders that they receive from the court and then serving them on a variety of different people that are involved in the internet space. And then the second part of the bill is concerns a particular civil cause of action, which is targeting websites that a rights holder believes are dedicated to theft of U.S. property. That has a technical definition we can dive into in the statute. And then allows a person to go after those websites in court, and then, assuming they are able to get a court order, then go after payment service providers and advertising networks to basically dry up the well to get the websites shut down by removing their sources of income.
Sorry, Andy. I was just going to ask you a quick question. How so? In terms of how you get a court order, what's the steps in terms of procedure that kind of lead you up to that point?
Sure. So when you start with the court order from the Attorney General's side, the Attorney General can basically select websites. There's a scope limitation there in that they should be foreign internet sites. The statute defines it in a bit in the negative. It has basically foreign internet sites are defined as not domestic internet sites. And then domestic internet sites are websites that where their registrar, the registry, the registration authority, or the servers are located inside of the United States. So assuming that they are not located inside the United States, the Attorney General can get an order against the website. Basically, they reference back to domestic websites when they select what types of websites can be targeted here. These are websites that would be subject to criminal copyright law or forfeiture provisions in copyright if they were operated inside of the United States. It's a little bit peculiar because we've already seen attempts by the Department of Justice using the in rem forfeiture sections of copyright law to go after websites located outside of the United States, which makes one question whether or not we need this bill at all. But assuming that they do, they then go before a court. The court is empowered in the statute to go after a temporary restraining order or a preliminary injunction or an injunction. There's a reference in the statute to Rule 65 of the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure. So law students should be able to perk up this right away and kind of remember how a Rule 65 process works. The certain evidentiary, or actually, I'm sorry, no evidentiary showings, but a certain likelihood of success on the merits that has to be demonstrated before a court before they can proceed. And that standard classic four-factor test of inadequacy of remedies at law and so on and so forth. And then court can issue based on that. The interesting thing and kind of the peculiar thing about this particular section is that it references this as well for the in rem. So for people that are not lawyers, it's probably helpful to take a second and describe the difference between in personam and in rem. When you're proceeding in personam in court, you're suing a party, a person, or a corporation, and it's you versus the party. When you proceed in REM, what happens is you're actually going up against the item itself. So this is a relic of sort of the courts of admiralty, where you had ships that had contraband, and you didn't always know who owned the ship or where that person was located. So you'd go after the ship as if the ship was a bad actor. We've taken that and used that in a couple different respects in the law in America, including with drugs and with other sort of facially obvious illegal things. But now we've expanded it to include items used in infringement of copyright and trademarks.
So does that mean that what you would have to establish a likelihood of success on the merits in order to seize the site too?
Well, that's the interesting question, is that the statute does not say for sure. It references the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure, which really contemplate only the in personam, and most of the stuff that's involved in that is an analysis of the in personam going after a person. And with respect to preliminary injunctions and injunctions, it's an adversarial hearing where you have both sides there arguing their respective sides and a judge ultimately deciding. Not the case, obviously, when you're going up against an object. There is a procedure in civil forfeiture in the criminal world, which is usually how these things are done, where a person who has a possessory interest can appear in court. But no, I mean, the likelihood of success would appear to just be the prosecutor and the judge in the room. And I think that's sort of the beginning of a lot of the problems that people see with this, is that no one is speaking to be the counter argument here. The hardest thing is, of course, with so many of these areas of law, is that it's very hard to know on a surface whether or not a website is infringing copyright in a way that subjects it to penalties and forfeiture. There are easy, obvious examples. There are clearly counter examples where it's clearly not infringing, but there's a lot of stuff in between. And of course, no one is speaking for the rights of the site if all you're doing is appearing in court and just trying to convince your judge on your own.
Of course, not to mention that all of these websites are supposed to be outside of the US. So in theory, the website operators, there's probably a strong likelihood that they're also outside of the US, so they might not be able to appear in a US court.
Yeah, that's the other concern, is that even if someone could show up, by their very definition, they're not likely to show up because they're located outside of the United States. But you know, the impact is certainly goes well beyond that, because assuming an attorney general gets this order, they can go after all sorts of different people, including service providers located probably inside of this country, but potentially those that serve people outside of the country. Service providers here appears to be a reference to internet service providers, but the way it's defined in the statute is just a service provider is someone who operates a non-authoritative DNS server. So now for the non-tech people in the room, the way in which we resolve names to numbers in the internet system is that we have these domain name servers. These are complicated system of servers that have registries based on certain top-level domains. So a server in Virginia controls the list of all the corresponding names for the everything that ends in .com. Similar servers exist for .org and all the country code domain names such as .uk. And then you have the system of registrars on top of that. Those are people like GoDaddy and Dotster, who are able to then sort of license out different names that have the corresponding top-level domains. Those run an authoritative DNS server. So we have these servers that tell all the other servers out there. Service providers, as defined in SOPA, are those that run the non-authoritative. So these are redundant servers, servers which usually copy these sorts of things for ease of the people they serve, such as an internet service provider doesn't check with VeriSign every single time they try and get to google.com. They learn the first time where the IP address for Google is and then keep it on their own servers so that, you know, me, Joe, Comcast user, wants to go find out where Google is. I don't have to have Comcast go all the way back to VeriSign. But they're allowed to then take measures to designed to prevent access. This has been an area of much contention, of course, in the bill, because originally it clearly contemplated doing DNS rerouting, what's called DNS poisoning in some areas, as well as sort of filtering and the other sorts of things that we typically associate with more authoritarian regimes than the United States. The law, as revised by Lamar Smith in mid-December, appears to push back a little bit on that, saying you don't have to do network monitoring. You don't have to do DNS filtering, though it kind of begs the question as to why they're defining the people here as the people who run DNS servers, but then say, oh, but you don't have to touch your DNS. But then, they basically have to employ any measure they can think of to try and prevent access. It's left pretty open-ended so that an ISP can pretty much decide how they want to do that, which is a classic move by Congress. If they don't know how to actually do something technically, they just say, well, you guys are smart, you guys figure it out.
So, I have a couple of questions I could throw out there for you guys, and maybe some thoughts of my own. Is there a problem that needs to be solved?
I've been talking for a while. Dominic, do you want to take this one?
Sure. The argument is basically that even though existing laws do make the actions that these sites do legal, there's actually no way to enforce these laws. So my understanding is that SOPA is primary and PIPA or PIPA, I'm not sure how to pronounce the acronym, and OPEN all try to basically make it so that the United States can enforce its intellectual property rights against these foreign pirates. And by doing these more draconian measures, they actually can get to the site by, for example, DNS poisoning the site. They're able to actually take the site down, whereas before they might say, "Well, you're doing everything illegal. We can't touch you because we can't actually get to you." That's the argument that the supporters give.
Yeah, I think that's a really nice synopsis. And then the counter argument is, of course, by making the procedures much more draconian, you're eliminating any chance to have a close call that winds up saying that it's non-infringing. Like I was saying earlier, it's very hard to tell a lot of the time whether or not a particular service or a particular website is doing something which violates American copyright law. To a certain extent, also, I mentioned American copyright law. We're projecting American copyright law into foreign spaces, which, as Americans, maybe we don't care so much about because it wouldn't change us our view either way. But of course, other countries certainly have other strong feelings. It's worth mentioning that a lot of these websites have been adjudicated as not illegal in their home countries before being targeted by the United States. So it becomes an opportunity where, without any real serious supervision, there's some homages to Rule 65. There's some discussion about what other procedures might be in place in civil forfeiture, but there's no adversarial system, and you're taking down websites before anyone from the website gets an opportunity to say, no, don't take me down, I'm not illegal.
But isn't that necessary to protect intellectual property rights of the content owners? Because if you don't immediately take the content down, then the content will just be allowed to be stolen over and over and over again, as you slog through a slow procedure that might not even result in success. Isn't it better to shoot first and ask questions later? Because if we let people pirate our content, we'll hurt our economy, lose millions of jobs and billions of dollars of revenue.
Yeah, I mean that would be the counter argument, right? And so the question, there's sort of two responses to that. One is sort of an empirical question. It's not clear. I'd say that there are obviously people who have strong studies on either side. If you talk to anti-piracy people on the Hill, they'll probably be able to cite you a handful of studies which show massive damages, loss in the hundreds of billions of dollars. And then you go to the tech circles and you talk to people with technology studies, and then you have saying that piracy has not actually hurt people because the people that are downloading are not people who would have bought if you had a standard pricing model, and that by attracting more attention to yourselves, by letting people sample your content, you're actually making money through other channels, and that there's actually a net benefit here. I don't think that either of those is right. My suspicion is that there is some economic harm here, but I don't think we know exactly what it is, and we don't think we know exactly where it's coming from. And in terms of the, we have to shoot now or else we're going to die out slowly. I think that there are other issues at stake here. When you have a website, what you really just have is a collection of speech. It's people writing and saying and doing certain things on their website that are expressed to the world at large. They're really just the world at large. It's really just an expression at its heart, and we value people's right to express themselves, assuming they don't do so in one of the narrow ways in which we say you can't express yourself in that way. And so obscenity comes to mind here. When you deal with obscene content, you don't always know. The line is often blurry as to what is, prohibitively, obscene and thus not allowed to be disseminated to the world, versus what is just, racy but totally legal and constitutionally protected. We don't tolerate these sorts of shoot first, ask questions later remedies in obscenity, and I don't think we should for copyright either, because if you're wrong, you've now silenced someone's speech without reason, without cause, and in violation of their rights.
So let's say that I have one of these websites that's abroad, and I have some questionable content on my site, and the Attorney General comes in and they seize my domain. I'm operating on a .com or a .org, and my web server is still going to be there. The content is still going to exist on that web server. It's still accessible as long as you know the IP address, and in fact, there might be ways for me to publish the location of where my web server is, the IP address, and let other people still access it. Is there any way for me to get my domain name back? Let's start there.
There is a remedy procedure where you can contest it, but I would certainly caution anyone who thinks that that's going to save all the problems here. So none of this is happening without a little bit of precedent. We, in 2008, drastically changed the scope of civil forfeiture law and intellectual property generally. We changed it from being just the ability to seize infringing copies and sort of the molds, matrices, and masters that you use to make those sorts of copies, to any property that can be used in the commission of infringement. And the Department of Justice and Immigration and Customs Enforcement seized on this and created a, I just realized there was a terrible pun in that sentence. They took advantage of that opportunity and they created a program they call Operation In Our Sites, where they go after these sorts of websites that they view as property that is used to commit infringement, and then use the court orders they get to go to domain name servers to reroute traffic away from those websites. People have contested it, saying, no, I'm completely legal here, and the DOJ has stonewalled them in every possible way. I know TechDirt ran a story a while ago regarding, I forget the exact client there, but the attorney was Andrew Bridges at Fenwick & West, and he had these terrible procedures that he had to go through where the DOJ would put motions under seal. They did all sorts of these tricks to try and keep arguments away from Andrew Bridges and from his client, and basically stalled him for about a year before they eventually released the domain name and said, whoops, sorry. So if passed as any prologue here, the DOJ is going to make it extremely difficult if they're going to, when it comes to releasing these things afterward.
But SOPA doesn't make a distinction between physical goods and digital goods, right? And the sort of broadening of copyright law made it so that you could attack digital goods, because before you didn't really have a way of getting to them. But now, since you can get through any material or anything using the digital good, or you being used in the act of infringement, then you can basically take anything that dealt with the copyrighted material in terms of it in its digital form, so their computers, everything.
Yeah, and I think there'd be less of a problem if you went after people for their infringing acts, and as part of your prosecutions of people, perhaps this is a good segue to our next story, you go after their physical goods. I mean, you wouldn't have a lot of the problems of the potential prior restraint of speech or of damaging the infrastructure of the internet if you proceeded like you used to do in the offline world, which is targeting people, conducting an adversarial proceeding where you contest whether or not a person is committing copyright infringement, and if they are, you then take their servers offline, or perhaps even give an injunction while you're determining that, though I think that that has some free speech concerns.
But I guess my question is SOPA distinguished between physical goods and digital goods? Because to me it seems like there's a massive difference in physical piracy as opposed to digital piracy. Physical piracy is going to involve, say, burning lots of DVDs and selling them to people, or making counterfeit handbags and shipping them to people. There's some physical good that's getting into the site visitor's hands eventually, and there's some transaction. Whereas digital goods, such as what Mega Upload pretty much got shut down for, I upload a ripped version of a movie to my Mega Upload site, I give you the password, you download the ripped version of the movie, nothing except for bits changes hands, but copyright infringement has occurred, and Mega Upload in this case has facilitated it and made money off of it if both of us have membership accounts at Mega Upload. But does SOPA distinguish between physical and digital goods? Because to me it seems like the enforcement avenues should be very different in between the two circumstances, because one is a lot easier because you have something physical that you can see and doesn't duplicate without cost.
Yeah, I mean, it doesn't really contemplate that, at least in the two sections we're talking about here, section 102 and then section 103, which is the civil cause of action that corresponds. It's a little more limited in scope, and as well as remedy, but neither one really contemplates a distinction. Basically, says if the website does something that is violative of copyright law, in the civil case, it actually has to be. It's actually it used to be only somewhat constrained. Now is more seriously constrained to be focused on the distribution of complete or substantially complete works, and it has to be the website has to be designed for or has no useful purpose other than or is marketed for. People who study legislation around copyright recognize those as the three secondary liability standards. That they are the websites themselves are subject to it. So it clearly contemplates largely digital goods, where you're right. I mean, the economics of it are uncertain because there is no cost to reproduction. There's no copies that are being deprived in the marketplace. The exact loss of based on sales is clearly not a one-to-one download to lost sale, and then is hotly contested what else it is if it's not one-to-one. There are some sections of SOPA that contemplate strictly physical goods. Towards the end of the bill, there's some stuff about selling mislabeled medicine or counterfeit medicine, or selling counterfeit goods to the United States government. These sort of trademark-based remedies, which are much more concerned about the sort of boots and handbags and jerseys that you see in the typical trademark cases, clearly contemplate physical goods instead of digital. But the copyright concerns here largely seem to be rooted in digital copies of creative works. I suppose we should say, we're recording this on the 2nd, and this morning we found out that the United States actually did seize a whole host of websites, about 300 websites in total, that were committing crimes they viewed under Operation In Our Sights. Actually, in this particular case, they call it Operation Fake Sweep, which my football friends tell me is actually a football play, where.
Well, we found that out after much Googling, I might point out.
That's right. We had a whole host of lawyers at the Berkman Center looking at videos of what a fake sweep is. But anyway, 307 websites were seized according to Torrent Freak. 16 of them were copyright focused. The rest were actually selling replica jerseys. So much closer to what you were concerned about, Dominic, physical goods traveling into the United States that are not licensed by their trademark owner. And the harm there can be a little more easily understood. Whether or not selling a fake one at $10 means I'm not going to buy the real one at $70 is obviously a contestable subject. But certainly, if I have it and it has a Patriots logo on it and it's of poor quality, as it probably is, and then it falls apart, and now I think poorly of the Patriots and their jersey manufacturers because of it, you can see where the harm to the manufacturer is a little bit more directly and a little bit clearer than you would in the copyright context.
I can see the chanting from the stands now at the Super Bowl. Patriots suck! Your jerseys are awful!
I'm sure there'll be much booing of the Patriots, but I'm sure it will not because of the poor quality of their jerseys.
So, if they just shut down all these sites, why is SOPA necessary? I mean, it seems like they have avenues of enforcement. What does SOPA do that wasn't possible before? What sites does it reach that we couldn't reach before, if any?
I mean, that's the real question. I mean, the early versions of the bill, COICA, which was the Combating Online Infringement and Counterfeits Act, that was actually it's a little over a year old now, I think, maybe a little less. But that clearly felt like an enshrinement of a procedure that the DOJ had invented using existing procedures. I mean, the thread that they hang all of these Operation In Our Sights cases on is the theory that the websites and the DNS servers are property used for the commission of infringement. What that means, whether or not a judge will say that it contemplates stuff as far remote as DNS servers, really just hangs on the interpretation of a statute. So the early versions felt like it was just a chance to say more explicitly by Congress, yep, we do want the Attorney General to be able to do this sort of stuff. Now I think because the SOPA remedies especially contemplate so much more than just DNS rerouting, which was an operation in our sights, I think that you see the opportunity for more creative levels of enforcement.
I guess the question still stands, though. Is there a need for it? And You pointed out the Operation In Our Sights, which has now been ongoing since June 2010, so we have more than a year and a half or so worth of. And they've done a number of these seizures, starting with the Cyber Monday crackdown in 2010, followed up with, I think, Operation Broken Hearted, which was a Valentine's Day 2011 a series of seizures, and then Operation Shoe Clerk, one that I had not been aware of previously until I started looking back into the history before the show today. And that one targeted commercial websites that were selling counterfeit goods, including shoes, boots, sneakers, jackets, and shirts. So, kind of getting back more into the tangible item counterfeit black market rather than the digital goods that we've been talking about. And there was also Operation Strikeout, which was going after websites that were selling counterfeit sports memorabilia, so Patriots jerseys, if you will. And then there might have been a few others or a few other announcements in between the last one and then, of course, the one that was announced this morning, Fake Sweep. But clearly, the ability to seize the domains has been there for some time, at least since 2008. And it seems to be working, at least as far as the Department of Justice wants it to work.
Yeah, so I think that the one thing that you don't see yet is it's a little bit limited in its scope. We've been going after, we being the United States, I guess, we've been going after websites that have top-level domains that are controlled inside of the United States. So what's been happening, and this is probably a big reason why this bill was out, is that you'll have a website like Roja Directa, which is a sports video streaming website. It used to exist at rojadirecta.com. Rojadirecta.com, of course, has the .com top-level domain. VeriSign in Virginia controls that domain, and so it was very easy for a court to issue an order that the attorney general could then present to VeriSign, as well as the registrar. I think it was GoDaddy that controlled the Roja Directa domain name, and get a court order that says reroute this traffic away from where you have it pointing now. Point it to our computer instead. And then you had, what Roja Directa did is exactly what you expect. I mean, their servers were still in Spain, and so they got a new top-level domain in Spain. And if you go to rojadirecta.es, which is the country code top-level domain for Spain, you will find them. They're still there. They're still operating. And because that top-level domain is being administered by a registry outside of the United States, it's a lot harder for the Attorney General to just go serve a court order. There's going to be a whole complicated back and forth in enforcement. I mean, if you've ever done international criminal enforcement before, you're probably familiar with like the letters rogatory proceedings, which can be extremely time consuming and extremely painful to go through. So I think a lot of this is now SOPA is a chance for people to say, look, we don't have to do all that, just filter out the traffic. Or just have your non-authoritative DNS point away from them. We haven't mentioned yet, but there is kind of a shadows of the old DMCA anti-circumvention law coming back here. Obviously, it still exists, but it comes back here as well because it makes it a crime to also circumvent any protection measures that a service provider implements with injunctive relief available at the request of the Attorney General.
So, if I type in an IP address, is that a circumvention measure?
Products that traffic in it, like trafficking in products that help you do it. So probably not a person typing in an IP address, but probably people who created like the Mafia Firefox extension. People like that, I think, is probably what they're contemplating there.
But the letter of the law would hit the person or not?
I would have to look at the letter of the law again, which I can do. Hang on.
Another site that moved its domain recently, the Pirate Bay, went beat to the piratebay.se, which is a Swedish domain. And does that make them not liable to be shut down? Like if you're not running on a .com or a .org?
Well, that
We were
was
talking
the
about
question. earlier today, actually.
Yeah, the big question with the Pirate Bay was always sort of like, well, we're going after websites that end in .org. Why haven't we gone after the Pirate Bay yet? And so that was a lingering question before. And now the theory is, at least the theory that Pirate Bay adopted, is that because there was still this case in Sweden pending, where the criminality of the Pirate Bay in under Swedish law was still being disputed, the United States may have taken a back burner role. That has some sense to it, at least on its surface, but of course, Roja Directa had been adjudicated as non-infringing in Spain, and they still went after it anyway, so they're not being consistent if that's the case. But when the Swedish court finally came down the way they did, the Pirate Bay decided that, that might have been taken as a cue to go after them, and then they hopped away so that at least they couldn't go after them by going after the .org registry.
Maybe a clever move, maybe just stalling the inevitable. I don't know.
Right. And then Dominic, to answer your question from earlier, the Attorney General can bring an action for injunctive relief against any entity that knowingly and willfully provides or offers to provide a product or service designed or marketed by such entity or by another in concert with such entity for the circumvention or bypassing of measures described in paragraph 2, and those are the measures taken to restrict access. So clearly not a person typing in an IP address into their browser. It seems like, based on my reading there, is that really going after people that are creating products that are helping people circumvent.
Right. So if I publish a script that says, oh, in case your site gets shut down, this script will log the IP addresses that you most recently accessed so that when it goes down, you can easily pull it up. That would be such a product.
Yeah, I mean, there are certainly non-circumventing reasons to do that, right? It's basically you're creating your own little authoritative DNS or non-authoritative DNS server there. But I guess maybe what the Attorney General might do is might go after you, because I think at that point you'd become a service provider under the letter of the statute because you're operating a non-authoritative DNS server, even if it's
Or
just for.
distributing host files.
Right. So I don't know how they'd go after you. I'm sure they'd find a way.
Do we want to move on to our next story?
Yeah, and before we do, there's another weird wrinkle to this, I think, and that's ICANN. ICANN, who manages the policy related to the DNS system, is a U.S. entity. It's the Internet Corporation for Assigned Names and Numbers, in case you're not familiar, and it is incorporated in California, and its existence is actually premised on a contractual agreement that they have with the U.S. Department of Commerce. And it's this very unusual quasi-public, quasi-private entity. It is incorporated. It has a private entity status, but again, its existence is premised on this agreement with the government, basically. And the government, of course, has set a term expiration period with that contract, and every couple of years that agreement expires, and their existence is kind of contingent on that contract being renewed. So it's not inconceivable that we would see, maybe in some backhanded ways, maybe it would be a bit more apparent, but the U.S. government becoming a bit more interested in the DNS, the policy making that ICANN does related to the DNS. And right now, the way that ICANN works is it's this, all the decisions are made through their board of directors. So I think it's between 12 and maybe 16 individuals, and those individuals are a portion of them are just plain directors, and others are members of their supporting organizations and their advisory committees, their ACs and SOs, and they focus on very specific issues, which then are filtered up to the board through usually the chairs of each of those organizations. So anyway, meant to be a global organization, but it's kind of complicated in the way that it works. But again, it's also this weird US entity, so I don't know what would happen in the future, but it's certainly possible that if some of these legislative efforts in Congress don't end up working out, that maybe that would be another way at some point in the future of how you might be able to exercise a bit of pressure on the DNS system.
I mean, that's a pretty stunning and chilling move if it was going to happen, because instead of sort of trying to operate within the space that the internet has created, you're basically attacking the internet structure itself. Do you think there'd be any chance for I guess like an internet revolution? Now that the structures are in place, could people just, sort of clone their own root servers and take over what ICANN does, if ICANN can't do it themselves?
I think we're already there, to be honest. There have been a number of stories that popped up in the last couple of months about hackers launching satellites into space to create basically a second internet or a second network of sorts that would be connected somehow to the internet. I mean, the internet does exist because of the DNS system, but there are a number of other layers to the technical infrastructure that actually comprise the internet, and the DNS is one, and it's definitely an important part of it, but it's not everything. So I'm pretty sure that the way that the way that it is structured now, and the way that people are thinking about some of these problems around the world, that they could quite easily come up with an alternative way to navigate the net if they wanted to.
That would be pretty remarkable and a pretty dramatic change if that was going to happen. Sort of, you know, taking a big step back and looking at sort of geopolitics, I wonder if this is sort of like the evolution of the internet as its own nation state, and it's sort of, you know, if this has been hit its sort of Articles of Confederation era, and if in fact we need now a constitution to have all the interests addressed.
Well, I thought we already had that.
Since the Constitution's more centralized than the Articles.
Yeah, that's fair. Maybe we're shifting away from the Constitution to the Articles. I don't know. This is a discussion for,
you know,
far nerdier than...
To me, it all comes back to John Perry Barlow with his Declaration of Independence for Cyberspace back in the 90s. Who will forget that?
Certainly not anyone who's filing an amicus brief against the Electronic Frontier Foundation. I don't know if you saw this in the news this week, but in one of the hard drive production cases, which is a series of these sort of what's been titled the reverse class action case, where a person sues, in this case I think it was close to 1,500 people for infringement, based I think on torrent hash IDs and things of that nature, and then tried to get anonymity subpoenas, and then when the EFF tried to intervene, saying that hey, there's privacy rights and free speech rights at issue here, you can't just go and demand the identity of all these people. They opposed the filing of an amicus brief there, and in so doing, basically quoted Barlow's Declaration of the Independence of Cyberspace, sort of to try and show that EFF was somehow this super radical organization, which I know is a common critique of theirs, but of course is not true if you know anything about EFF.
Oh, interesting stuff. Well, we can talk for just a bit about our second story, but in a lot of ways it overlaps with this first one. And that's, of course, the Mega Upload case. And if you've been following it all, the news, you'll probably have heard about Kim.com or Kim Schmitz, I think, which was his name at birth. In short, Mega Upload has rather swiftly been shut down after a January 5th indictment, which was filed in the United States. Now, here's the odd part of this. Mega Upload it was founded in March 2005, and it's since then, I believe, it's been located in Hong Kong, or at least for the last couple of years, it's been located in Hong Kong. And it, at its height, I'm told that it was the 13th most popular site on the internet, although I think the Alexa rankings are much lower now, but still placing the domain in the top 100 sites. And apparently at its peak in terms of website traffic, it was there were more than 50 million visitors a day and over 180 million registered users using the site. Accounted for 4% of all internet traffic too, is another statistic that I keep hearing. The company itself though only has 150 employees. But since March 2005, they've apparently made $175 million in revenue, and the indictment was filed this month for copyright infringement, but criminal copyright charges actually. Hit the news about January 20th when Kim.com, that's the CEO, was arrested in Auckland, New Zealand, and is apparently awaiting extradition to the United States. And we'll get back into that in a little bit, but Mega Upload is kind of an interesting site in the way that it works. It's basically marketed as a digital locker, and there's a couple different types of users that they have in the site. Anyone can go to, when the site was up at least, anyone could go to the site and download things so long as they had a link to where the file was located. If you have an account, you would get some additional privileges on the site, and there were different levels of accounts that you could have. There were premium accounts, and then there were lower level accounts, and then just accounts for people who simply registered with an email address. But at the highest of those levels, they would give you fast file reproduction service, and they would allow you to download files without any delay. Apparently, they would have delays on downloads for non-registered users, and they would also have file size limitations and a few other things. But they also offered these weird upload rewards program points. And if you accumulated enough points by uploading content to the site, they would actually pay you cash in some circumstances or give you other financial incentives. And they were in particular looking for copyrighted works, or at least so the filings allege. So the users would upload these files to the site, and they would get a unique download URL link, which then they could share with anybody else. And if people went to that link, they'd be able to download the file. But if for some reason those URLs were not visited within a specified period of time, and it kind of depended on the level of the user account, the files would actually be deleted from the servers, and you could no longer go to those links and find the files there. So, but if they had been accessed, if people were downloading them, so consider if there was like a really hot file that everyone was sharing around and downloading a lot, then the file would stay up on the site for as long as people were interested in it, basically. But aside from that, aside from having the URL, that is, content was not searchable on the website, at least not by normal internet users. And of course, this kind of became a hotbed of copyright infringement activity. Basically, an anonymous file sharing service located abroad, which makes it difficult, as we've just been talking about, to assert jurisdiction over, whether that's legal or if it's law enforcement actually enforcing something against them. They made money through these premium accounts, so you would have to pay various amounts of money either on a monthly basis, or I think you could even get a lifelong premium account if you wanted to, for just a couple $100s. And they were also making a smaller amount of money from advertising on the site. So that's what comprised the $175 million in revenues. And they were shut down pretty quick this week.
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly a very interesting case to follow. David, did you want to quickly run through what they were charged with?
Mostly conspiracy counts to commit criminal copyright infringement. So the interesting thing here is that we've also seen kind of similar cases in the U.S. If you recall back to the Viacom and Veo case, actually the Veo case just came up again not more than 2 months ago, where you had the owners or operators of websites being sued for infringement that was being committed by users of the site. So the owners and operators might not have known or had knowledge of the fact that any copyright infringement was occurring, but the users who were actually committing the copyright infringement did know about it. And the copyright owners in those instances sued the owners of the website, and they're the ones with the deep pockets. That would make a lot of sense if you were looking for some of those sweet statutory damages that the Copyright Act has to offer. But they did so unsuccessfully because, of course, we have the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, and the DMCA provides some liability limitations so long as you comply with a notice and takedown system, which is set up in the statute. If you do ignore it, though, you can run into some trouble, and as far as I know, that hasn't really happened on a large scale yet with any of the major tech companies in the U.S. But what makes it a little bit different in this case for the mega upload people, and we are talking about U.S. law here, by the way, even though that this was a company located in Hong Kong and that Mr. Kim.com was arrested in New Zealand, this is very much a U.S. action. And but for criminal copyright charges, actually, it's not so clearly established in the U.S. that you can have secondary liability. That is, that you aren't the person that is actually committing the direct infringement. Rather, you're benefiting from it in some way, or you're inducing it in some way, or materially contributing to it in some way. That hasn't really been tested so much here, as I understand, in the U.S.
Yeah, I was actually doing some research preparing for the podcast, and I remember that the Department of Justice actually publishes their manual for intellectual property enforcement. And in the section where they're talking about whether or not secondary liability can be applied, they recognize that it probably would come up as an aiding or abetting charge, which is in the United States Code, it's Title 18, Section 2. But they mentioned that, you know, this probably could include an inducement theory. I think the exact language they use is that it's unsettled, and let me see. So we'll cut in where I actually sound like I know what I'm talking about here. That further decisions following the Grokster case will likely provide further guidance on how inducement theory may be applied in criminal copyright cases. So it doesn't sound like the DOJ knows, though they're clearly pursuing on this theory.
Perhaps not, but there has to be a test case at some point, I guess. And if it's going to be a test case, why not make it a big one, right?
Yeah, there's certainly enough sort of ancillary bad action alleged in the indictment that makes Mr. Dotcom a very unappealing defendant. Of course, these are all allegations. We'll see whether or not they're proven true later. It's certainly unclear at this point.
Why doesn't the site fall under 230 fair use? Or not fair use, but the Internet Service Provider exemption?
Well, Section 230 doesn't apply to intellectual property. Instead, it would go to the Digital Millennium Copyright Act. And then whether or not they qualify is sort of they shot themselves in the foot there. Again, if this is true, it appeared that they did not actually register an agent with the Copyright Office, which is a requirement
Ouch.
For DMCA protection, until 2009. So big lesson to all people who host websites that deal with user-generated content, register an agent. It's the best $150 you'll ever spend in terms of protecting your IP rights or your IP liabilities, I should say.
Yeah, you're right about the exemption to intellectual property.
Yeah, and also that the 230C limitations only would limit your civil liabilities, correct?
I think that's correct. It's been a while since I've looked at that part of Section 230, since we usually see it come up in the defamation context, which 99% of the time is a civil claim.
Yeah, and it's, you know, it's unusual to point out we don't often, in the past, we haven't talked a whole lot about the criminal aspects of copyright infringement. Really, the one of the key differences in the statute is that you're doing it for a commercial purpose, and that's what, of course, was alleged in the U.S., the filings in the U.S. here against Mega Upload. And so, to illustrate this, what's exactly going on in the case? That this is a 72-page filing. They basically went through a series of factual allegations that would hopefully, for them, establish why Mega Upload or why the owners and operators of Mega Upload would be secondarily liable. And they pointed to the fact that all of the revenues from the service came from the premium accounts and online advertising. And they pointed out that on the back end in their database, they were using a MD5 hash in order to store the file. So every file gets its own unique MD5 hash. And once you know what the MD5 hash is, you can quickly search your database to determine if there are any duplicate files that are already stored. And so it's a kind of a quick way to save on storage space in the database, so you're not hosting multiple duplicates of the same file. They pointed out that the administrators would have likely been aware while they were making that system what the needs were for the system, what the needs for the system would have been, and what kind of files that they would have been storing. And that would probably entail, you know, doing some small investigation and figuring out what the file names were. But it goes much deeper than that. Since 2010, the US FBI and Department of Justice apparently were doing electronic surveillance on the Mega Upload executives. They were listening in on some of their Skype sessions. They were capturing emails here and there, mostly just the services that passed through the United States, as I understand it. So they were doing this monitoring locally, not internationally at the time. And they also served warrants, apparently, on a hosting facility that's located in Virginia. Didn't know this before, but Mega Upload owned and operated, or actually they leased and operated about 500 servers in Virginia. And they also had other servers around the world, including in the Netherlands and in Hong Kong and a few other places. But it looks like the way they had the website set up, it was pretty spread out. But some of it was located in the U.S., and that was probably a mistake, by the way. And after they had issued this warrant, they had determined back in 2010 that there were a number of infringing files that were being stored in their system. And they notified Mega Upload about it and gave them a year to comply with an order, I think, that they had gotten from a court to remove the files. They never did, and they never responded to any of the attempts by the Department of Justice to contact them. The other interesting thing that kind of makes them a little bit different than some of the other cases in the U.S. is that they had a top 100 files list. This was something that we saw in some of the other big file sharing service cases, where on the homepage of the website, they would have a list of the top files that were available. And among those, you would often see, like in the top 10, the hot motion pictures of the week or the hot new albums. And basically, that would be used in court to suggest that the websites were not only aware that there was infringing activity going on, but they're actually also actively promoting it. And in this case, the top 100 list that they have, though, it didn't list any motion pictures. Instead, it listed the trailers and free software trials. And so apparently it was made, according at least to the filings, it was made to portray the website as being much more benign than apparently the US government thinks that it is.
Yeah, it's been very interesting. I mean, you saw the top 40 thing. I believe it was in the Grokster case. I can't remember if it was Morpheus or Grokster that did it, but that was used as part of a theory of inducement liability, which is probably exactly why it's included here in the indictment. They're clearly, I mean, reading the indictment, they're clearly trying to get them in every possible theory of copyright they possibly can, trying to show both direct infringement. In fact, one of the worst things, I think, if you're trying to defend Mega Upload here, is actually something that's kind of benign in the context of the whole indictment, but the fact that while trying to build up Mega Video, they scraped and copied in YouTube in its entirety, which is just a massive example of direct infringement for the purposes of financial gain. So they kind of got directly hit there. They also try to assert contributory and vicarious based on how they're profiting and how they're encouraging others, and inducement. And then also trying to show that they would fail the safe harbors even if they qualified them because they didn't respond to request to remove content, as you were mentioning earlier.
The last thing, I guess, before we tie this week off to talk about is the international aspect of this, which is really fascinating. So it's a company that's located in Hong Kong. One of the guys is arrested in New Zealand, but this was all sort of done in coordination with the FBI and the DOJ. So we're back to the original question that we had. Why is it that we need a SOPA or a PIPA or a COICA if it's possible now for the FBI to work with foreign governments and even outside of the U.S. jurisdiction, outside the territorial boundaries of our country, they can enforce our laws like this? Why would we possibly need to make any changes to the Copyright Act?
Well, I think because it's difficult to enforce the laws, and it requires time and money to actually. I mean, there's a trade-off here, right? There's the trade-off between easily shutting down any site you suspect of infringement and being able to go through a process which might allow sites to continue to infringe, might create barriers to removing infringement because it costs time and money to interface with the government to actually get the site shut down. So there's a trade-off here, and I think the difference is where people want to put the balancing, the fulcrum of that trade-off, whether people want to trade so that you have a lot of flexibility in terms of what you can post online, or whether, as the content owners seem to say, that we should have a much, much stricter policy where it's a lot easier to take stuff down if there's even a whiff of infringement.
Right, and of course, that sort of presents the counterargument pretty directly, of course, which is that, this is an avenue of free expression that is now being seriously threatened by all of these allegations of infringement. That if you wanted to follow copyright law to the letter, you would find that every single person lives their life at some moment infringing copyright in one form or another. I can't remember if that was Pam Samuelson or Jessica Litman that made that observation, but you can barely go, a day without somehow bumping into copyright law and doing something which might be considered infringing, not criminally infringing of course, but certainly civilly infringing. And so it gives tremendous power to the content industry to control what's happening all around them just because people are coming into contact with their content, not even directly in some of these circumstances. And there is sort of a funny question of enforcement. The weird thing hanging behind all of this is that yes, the dot com was in New Zealand, and several other people were in Germany and such. But rapper Swizz Beatz is alleged to be the CEO of this company. He is married to Alicia Keys, who's one of the biggest bread makers for the content industry, at least on the music side, in a decade. It's now being sort of disputed whether or not he is or he was not involved with the company. But if he's even plausibly involved with the company, why didn't the DOJ go after him as well? Because he's been clearly contributing to the mega upload conspiracy, as they keep calling it. They didn't probably because it was probably going to be very unpopular amongst the content industry. And if all we're doing is just having the government follow the content industry's commands, it really throws a lot of other things into question as well.
Yeah, so what's left for Mr.com is kind of interesting. So for the extradition procedures, normally with extradition treaties, I believe that the key question is usually if the offense that was committed in one country is considered to be a crime in the other country. Because you have to remember that he was arrested by New Zealand officials, and so New Zealand officials would have had to have the authority to arrest him in the first place under New Zealand law, even though they might have been doing it in coordination with the FBI and the DOJ. From there, you also look to what the similarities were between the New Zealand law and the US. But I think that this is typically a process that drags on for several months at a time.
Yeah, I think the real trade-off here is basically that we have existing business models that content owners have made a lot of money with, and they want to continue to make a lot of money with it. But the internet is challenging those business models and making it more difficult for them to make money with their old-style business models. So it's expensive and risky to adapt a business model and try something new that might not work. So it's cheaper to lobby Congress and get laws to sort of protect your existing business model and enshrine it in law, making it so that you can protect it through the force of the law and make it difficult for competing business models to emerge. And that's what they're doing. It's economically the correct play for them. It's not the perhaps what might be best for everyone involved, but in terms of just protecting shareholder value, protecting their industry, protecting their way of making money, they're behaving as perfectly rationally from their perspective. They make money this way, they're going to want to keep making money this way. Why in the world would they make it more difficult? Why would they open doors for competitors? I mean, if you look at it, the music industry could have made their own iTunes had they wanted to, and they could have been making a lot more profit than working with Apple had they just built their own store. The MPAA could do the same thing. They could make it really easy to buy and watch movies online, and rent them and share them with friends. They could create something like Steam for online movies, and it would be an amazing service. People would use it. They would make tons of money, but it might not work if they don't have the technical expertise. It might fail horribly, and why take the risk? I mean, why invest all that money into creating something that might not work, that might fail horribly, when they can just keep making money as they are?
Right, I mean, I think that that's one of the classic problems with what's been going on with intellectual property in the past 10 years or so. But I think one of the more interesting things is that both the stories we had today are these major actions by the government trying to do what the industry wants them to do, and it really feels like they're coming from a position of monetary influence than actually sound policy. The copyright is commanded in the Constitution as a way of incentivizing the creation and dissemination of works. And it might be that these are the sorts of things we need to do to create and disseminate works and to sort of maximize the creative output of America. But it's unclear. I'd say it's a very loose shot at best as to whether or not this is in fact going to actually improve the chances of anyone creating and disseminating works. Jonathan Coulton, who's a really awesome singer-songwriter, musician guy, had a lot of critical things to say about the seizure of Mega Upload that I think was summarized in a tweet very succinctly that we'll have to link to because I don't remember exactly what it said, but essentially said something to the effect of, "Wow, I can't believe how much money I've made since Mega Upload has been shut down," in sort of a snarky way. In fact,
It's also worth noting that there were a lot of legitimate users who probably lost access to their files at the service after the servers were seized in the United States. And I also didn't mention, but the U.S. government, I think, was able to seize a lot of the assets that were located around not only in the U.S. but around the world in various bank accounts. And so it would be quite difficult for the companies to continue operating, considering that it no longer has money to pay its bills.
Now we've made it so they cannot do their business before we've actually determined if they're guilty or not. The quote, by the way, Care of Dominic, is that any other musicians out there notice that ever since they shut down Mega Upload, the money has just been pouring in, from Jonathan Coulton there. Of course, being snarky, saying that.
Thanks again for listening to this week's episode. As I mentioned in the blog post that went up just a few weeks ago, we'll probably be publishing podcasts on a less frequent basis, but we hope to kind of give you a little bit greater depth. It will continue to be a podcast of indeterminate length, but we hope that Andy will continue to join us as we move on.
I was just going to say it's been a lot of fun, and I want to thank David and Dominic for inviting me in. I hope we can do a lot more of this in the future.
Absolutely. You're very welcome. On that note, we'd like to thank you for listening to this week's show. As always, you can find our blog and podcast on the web at technicallylegal.org, and you can check out our Twitter feed, which we will be reviving also in due time, and that is TechLegal on Twitter. And feel free to send comments and story suggestions to podcast at technicallylegal.org. Signing off, I'm David O'Brien.
I'm Dominic Rabier.
And I'm Andy Sellers.
We'll see you next time.